getting my fingers loosened up. You were here last week, you know why. If you weren't here last week, you get a review. If you weren't here last week, you get to learn with us. We are memorizing the Ten Commandments in order, on demand, for the rest of your life. Courtesy of my friend Gary Mays, who taught me how to do this some 25 years ago. So that just proves right there it does stick. If you will diligently follow that letter and practice along with me, do the best of your ability. So get your fingers loosened up. You need all 10 for 10 commandments. God made you with 10 fingers. Imagine that. All right, so we're toes. I guess you use toes. That'd be good. Well, it'd be weird, church. You use toes. Okay, so 10 fingers. 10 hands.
10 hands.
Now it's really getting weird. All right, first commandment. What we do is there's a phrase with each commandment that helps us learn the commandment. It's not the commandment itself. That's the tricky part. But it reminds us of what it is. So the very first one, you take your first finger, you do this. It's really tricky, I know. This is hard. You don't learn for 25 years unless you actually do this. God is number one. Say that.
God is number one.
Except the commandment is, you shall have no other gods before me. And that was less warm than the God of the one part. Number two, the one we're going to focus on today when we get to the teaching part of this. Make scissors. That's right. So we're going to cut out idols. The commandment is, you shall not make any graven image. Okay? Or don't make idols, don't make graven images. Number three, what letter is that?
W,
which stands for watch your words. That's right. Matthew's helping me teach over there. Watch your words. And the commandment is, do not take the Lord's name in vain. This is cool, right? Number four. This is one of the stretches right here. This one's, you had to make it fit, had to make it work. Four fingers. Picture four people in a 4x4 going to church on Sunday. You don't have to say all that. But just picture it in your head. Four people in a 4x4 going to church on Sunday. And the fourth commandment is, honor the Sabbath and keep it holy.
Honor the Sabbath and keep it holy.
You're not allowed to keep the Sabbath holy? I don't know. So, you guys honor the Sabbath today in the rain by coming and braving the weather after staying up till midnight watching a baseball game. I'm proud of you. Number five, saluting motion. Because the commandment, well, salute, honor your father and mother.
Honor your father and mother.
Going hard for all the younger folks in the crowd. Right? Number six, that's not the thing. Number six, except, don't do that. The commandment is, thou shalt not kill.
Thou shalt not kill.
That's fun, right? It's almost like being in like vacation Bible school again, when number six or something. Number seven. Seven people at a party. Two of them slip away and commit adultery. But the commandment is, don't commit adultery. You with me?
Thou shalt.
There we go. We got the thou shalt in there. Number eight. This one admittedly is another stretch and kind of fun. In a Middle Eastern country, if you steal something, they will cut off your hand. At least that's the old traditional thing. So if you steal a grape at the grocery store, they cut off your pinky finger and you plug it with your thumb. Again, the commandment is not to steal. So the commandment is, thou shalt not
steal.
That was good. Thou shalt not steal. That was good. Okay, now, if you lie, your finger grows back. But the commandment again is, thou shalt not
lie.
You with me? You got these all memorized now, right? Now, 10. This reads, with both hands, the thing you want more than anything else that somebody else has, don't do that either. Thou shalt not. See? Now you know all 10 on the order. On time, on cue. If I call on you, you can just say, I said, what's the fifth commandment you have? Honor your father and mother. Okay. Just give me six, it's fun. Especially with the sound effects.
Yeah.
That's Matthew's favorite right there. So, yeah, so that's the Ten Commandments in an overview, and we're going to focus on the second commandment today. So turn with me to Exodus chapter 20. We're going to read the first six verses just to get through the second commandment there. Then God spoke all of these words. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them. For I am the Lord your God, and a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of their parents, to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. Woo! I read the first and second commandment together so that you can hear them be said. The first one is, God's the one, you shall have no gods before me. And then the second one, you shall not make a graven image, you shall not make idols, and you shall not bow down and worship them. Now, when you read that, you kind of go, they sound kind of like they're the same commandment. There can be an argument made that they are one commandment. He's just elaborating on not having other gods. Right? But there is a distinction. The distinction is in these two words that are in there. It says, you shall have no other gods before me. You shall not, God's number one, put no other god ahead of me. Worship nobody but me. And the second commandment is, you shall not make an image. So the first commandment talks about having God in your heart, in your desire, who you worship, who you dedicate your life to. We talk about the fact that God is conscripting and commanding a relationship in the first commandment. In the second commandment, he goes to cutting out idols. He basically says, you shall not make an idol for anything in heaven or above. In other words, we create our idols. Things that we make, things that we pursue, things that we possess, we make them an idol in our life. Money. I mean, we don't make anybody like carve their image this past weekend so they could like bow down and worship it. We don't call, we're not idol makers, or are we? I know I've said this on a couple of other occasions. You can't not worship. English majors hate me right now, so don't make it. You can't not worship. You can't. What do I mean by that? You're going to worship something. If you're not religious, you're going to worship a career, a significant other, money, the pursuit of money, something. You can't not worship something. So God says, have no other, worship no one but me. Don't create gods in your life that you give yourself to instead of me. Don't make them. See, what we do is we set up things that are the driving force of our life. It might be a career, it might be a significant other, been chasing forever, and it becomes so important. And by the way, side note here, idols are not always evil things. Is a career an evil thing? Your parents would say, no, have a career, please. You know, career is not an evil thing. Having money is not an evil thing. So sometimes idols are good things, or things that God designed for good, we make into an idol. Because it becomes so central and so important to us that it crowds out God in our life. Does that make sense? And so it becomes the driving force. In the Old Testament, Abraham, we won't go over the whole story because he's in like 10 chapters of Genesis or whatever. But one of the stories is he's waiting for his firstborn son at 98. I thought having a kid at 50 was rough. He's waiting for his first kid at 98 years old. Can you imagine those 2 a.m. meetings when you're 98? You know what I mean? So he's waiting for a kid. He's waiting for a kid. He's waiting for a kid. Isaac comes along, and then God says, hey, Abraham, take Isaac up on the mountain and sacrifice him. Wait, I waited 98 years. Do I have to wait another 98 after I sacrifice? Like, can you imagine? Now, why would God challenge Abraham to do that? Has having a son become an idol for Abraham? That was the question. So God's not like, I can't wait to see you slaughter your son. He wanted to see Abraham's response. He wanted to see if being a dad had become an idol for Abraham. Jesus has an encounter with the rich young ruler. Rich young ruler says, what must I do to be saved? Jesus says, keep these commandments. You can name them, right? It's like, honor your father and mother, don't kill, don't steal, don't commit adultery, some of those. And Richard Rohler says, I've kept all those since I was little. Man, so
coach uses that. That's pretty interesting.
He says, I kept all those. He goes, what else must I do? And he says, sell everything you have and come follow me. And the scriptures tell us that the rich young ruler was sad because he had great wealth and turned and walked away. He may have kept honor dad, honor dad and mom. He may have kept don't kill. He may have kept don't steal. But he was breaking the first two over wealth. He could not let them go. They had become the driving force in his life. And when Jesus says, all you have to do is sell everything and come follow me, he couldn't do it. Scripture tells us he walked away sad. He couldn't let him go. That's the definition of the Bible. It's the thing in your life that if God asks you, like Abraham or a rich young ruler, to give it up, your heart would skip a beat because you just know you can't. That's an idea. But if God actually called you to let it go, could you? Coffee. Right? God intended it for good. It's an idol. Give it up? No. This is what freaks everybody out of Lent. Gotta give up chocolate and coffee for Lent. You know, like, if God says, I want you to give this up, can you? There's a defining question. Why is this true? Why are we idol factories? Why are we idol makers? Why do we elevate things in our life? There are two reasons, I think. Number one, it's our nature. Wait, what? We are finite. We are limited. And God is like this spirit. You can't see. Right? He's out there. You saw him with Jesus on earth. Right now, we can go, hey God, how you doing? I said, shake your hand. Like, that kind of blows our finite minds. You with me? Like, there have been plenty of days when you wish Jesus was sitting right here so you could ask him a question and he would respond back and you're here. You ever had those days, right? And so what we tend to do is, since we can't understand God, we can't sit here and go, hey God, what's going on this afternoon? Like, have that kind of dialogue. We tend to fill in the gaps. We tend to put God into a limited set of understandings that we can go, oh, I can get my brain around this because we're limited. How do I know that we do this? People say things like this. The God I worship would never do this. The Jesus I know does this, or says this, or believes this. That phrase is not wrong. But it tells us we've got categories for God. We've got this box that we put him in. We've got an understanding of who Jesus is and God is in the way that we can understand it. And so we pour our little categories, and that's where God fits. God can never give an 8-year-old man a son. Ask Abraham about that. Right? So we put limits on God. Why? Because we, in our own nature, are limited in our capacity and understanding. If I said to you, God's always existed, God will always exist, and the brain goes. Because we're finite. We can't handle that information. But how do you always exist? It has to be before God, right? Something. So there's a limit. And so what we do is we create symbols that represent other things. Are you with me? That's why we have, like, crosses at church. That's why we have religious things that we, oh, that's a, there's a cross. I'll put turn around if right there. We have crosses at church to symbolize what? Christ's sacrifice for us, right? Because we can wrap our brain around this. We can say, this is, we have an altar, we come down and we kneel, and that kneeling represents our submission to God. Those things are symbols. They're normative symbols that represent something else. The American flag represents the country to the world. But it doesn't have the qualities of this, of what it symbolizes. This cross is not Jesus. The flag represents America, but it's not America. It symbolizes what it stands for, something else. The problem is, over time, because we're limited in our nature, because we're limited in our understanding, the symbol becomes the sacred. That's why you always sit where you always sit in church. You know that, right? I got my pew, been sitting here since 1938, you know, whatever, like, the symbol becomes the sacred. For us, it takes on what it represents. Why do you think we think burning the flag is so wrong? They're not burning down America. But for us, it's the same thing. And so the symbol becomes sacred. Don't change what you do on Sunday. If this table disappeared from connection, some of us would go, look, that's our altar. It's become sacred. I'm saying it's 20 years. But it's become sacred because it's always been here. And we connect it with our spiritual experiences of God. The light streams have always been here. If they were gone, we'd be like, where's the light streams? The symbol becomes sacred. And so when we say that this is God, we make symbols in our life, we make these things in our life, they become sacred, and they become where we can't let go of them. Don't dare change what's become sacred. But what they did was represent something. You know, this church can only meet at 11 o'clock on Sunday. Jesus is not available any other time of the week, right? Or 8:40 if you're an 8:40 person. You know, Saturday night at 7, Jesus isn't there Saturday night at 7. That would be weird. Even the hour that we have church has become sacred. But God is with us all the time. I was talking about this with somebody this week, like, you know, Moses in the burning bush. Moses is a shepherd. He's hauling his sheep around in the desert, and he sees this bush off in the distance, and he goes over to check it out, noticing it's not burning up. And then God says to him, take off your sandals. This ground is holy. That pastor friend of mine goes, did Moses immediately wonder how long the ground had been holy? Because he's bringing sheep through there all the time. Next thing he knows, wait, but this is holy? I just let the sheep kind of like, did your thing here last week? Sorry about that. You know, like, when did this become sacred ground? It's always been sacred. Always. Over time, they do. The Ark of the Covenant was the actual symbol of God's presence with his people. You know the thing Indiana Jones chased after? Indiana Jones chased after was the symbol of God's presence. And so the people of God meant, if we just have the Ark in front of us, we'll win the battle. The Ark had become God's presence, not a symbol of God's presence. And so they would defy God. They would just take the Ark and assume they would still win because they were treating the Ark like it was God. So these idols that we make become our gods. None of us, like, have a little carbon image, a little altar in our home that we bow down to anymore. We have lots of things that we bow down to. We have lots of things that we bow down to. Netflix, you get rid of that. Right? So, sleeping in on Sunday morning, you know, I can disturb still of it. The second reason that this is about who we are and why we make idols is an issue of control. We want to control our reality. So if I make something, guess what? I'm in control of it. If money is my idol, I can control my money. I can control how I spend it. I can control how I invest it. I can take care of it in a certain way. I can make it be what I need it to be. So we make these idols. We make these things sacred because A, they're right in front of us where we can see them. And B, we can control them. And so we make that the nature of our relationship with whatever it is. Hey, I'll worship that because at least I can track that. The way it comes is proven. By the way, the scriptures do not say that money is evil. Just to correct this misconception, it says the love of money is evil. Why would it say the love of money is evil? Anything you love more than God is by definition an idol. So what's evil is not having money. It's not being willing to give it up if God called you to give it up. A lot of rich young ruler. Sell everything you have and come follow me. Couldn't do it. Does that mean if you're a Christian, you can sell everything you have in order to follow Jesus? No. What Jesus doing was, hey, I know your heart. You say you keep these commands, but you've broken the first two. I'm going to ask a question that points it out. He was going after that rich young ruler's heart. When I ask you to give up your money, you won't be able to. You'll know where you stand. Rich young ruler didn't go, oh, you're right, I should sell everything. If he did, he wasn't holding on to it too tight. Had he responded with, you're right, Zacchaeus, that's exactly what Zacchaeus did, right? All Jesus says, I'm having lunch with you today, and Zacchaeus goes, cool, I feel so blessed by this, I'm giving up everything, and hey, back you can double what I stole from you. Completely different response to what the presence of God did in their lives. confrontation that God did in their lives. Now, this is one of the first three commands that has a contingency clause on it. Did you notice that? Remember last week we talked about the suzerain vassal treaty. God says, if you keep these commandments, I will bless you. If you don't keep these commandments, I will curse you. This is what a conquering king would tell the nation that it was conquering. Hey, we're coming in and taking over. Here's the rules of the land. If you keep them, you'll be all right. If you don't, I will send my army in to smash you again. And Moses goes, hey, it's a good way to write the Ten Commandments. I'm Lord your God. I brought you out of Egypt. If you keep these commandments, I will bless you. If you do not keep these commandments, it will not go well. Similar form. Verse 5. He says something very, very, very interesting about God's law. So let's talk about that. Exodus chapter 20, verse 5. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for their iniquity of their parents to the third and fourth generation of those who reject me, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. There's a couple things in there that ought to make you do away with. One, God jealous. Jealousy's bad. God's jealous. How does that work? What does he mean? We hear jealous, we think possession, relationship, they're jealous of whatever, or they're jealous of my career, they're coveting my car, you know, whatever. We think jealous, that they don't have what you have. In this context, it's more about zeal or passion. Think covenant. The context is, don't worship other gods, because I am the Lord your God, and we are entering into a covenant together that says, I will bless you if you keep them and you, and vice versa. God is binding himself to the people of God with conditions. Breaking the conditions makes him passionate about it. It makes him zealous. It makes him jealous. You can even think of this as a marriage covenant between God and his people. That's why Paul says, our relationship with God, the church, is the bride of Christ. It's a marriage relationship. They are sealing into themselves to each other. These commandments are the conditions. And so God says, if you're unfaithful to me, I'm going to be upset about it. That's what he says. Then he lays down a consequence. If you're not, if you reject me, it'll impact you for the third and fourth generation. Which sounds really evil. So he goes, if you keep my commandments, I'll bless you to the thousandth. Now, as God, to quote Bruce Almighty, sitting there with a magnifying glass, waiting to burn your feelers off and see what you do? No, that's not what this is about. But if your family, if your parents reject God and don't teach faith in the home, what's likely to happen for the next three or four generations? How likely are your children to follow Christ? And if they don't, what's their life likely to be like? Are you with me? That if you reject my covenant, if you reject me and my people, if you reject following me, it'll haunt you for generation after generation after generation. But if you love me and keep my commandments, you'll be blessed for 1,000 years. He's just saying, look, if you're not going to follow this, if you're not going to keep the deal, it's going to have a deep, long-lasting effect. In fact, this idea of idolatry says this. It's almost, when I say it's like marriage covenant, it says, you can use my marriage language. You shall have no other gods before me. Forsaking all other gods, worship me alone. You get the idea now? I am Lord your God. I am the one who delivered you out of Egypt. For our New Testament context, Jesus could say, I am the Lord your God. I am the one who delivered you from sin and death. If you love me, you will keep my commandments. Jesus literally says that in John 15. I am the vine, you are the branches. If you love me, those who love me will keep my commandments. Sounds a little bit like Jesus read Exodus 20. Sounds a little bit like Jesus knows what he's talking about. We are in a bride of Christ, with Christ being the spouse, relationship with Jesus. And the expectation is we would be faithful to that relationship. If not, course, his anger is going to kindle against us if we're unfaithful. What spouse would not be angry or upset if their spouse is unfaithful? Would you be? So what do we do? The phrase for the commandment is, come on, help me out. Cut out idols, that's right. The commandment actually is, don't make graven images, don't make idols, right? Don't make them, don't possess them, don't worship them instead of me. So the calling then is for us to literally cut out idols from our life. The things that we consider more than God, the things that answer that question I asked you earlier, that I asked you to give it up, God asked you to give it up, I would never ask you to. If God asked you to give it up, could you? Do it, or if you so freak out, you walk away sad, like a rich young ruler. This is Colossians chapter 3. So, if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above where Christ is, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things above, not on the things that are on the earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory. Put to death, therefore, whatever is in you that is earthly. Fornication, impurity, passion, evil desire, greed, which is idolatry. On account of these things, the wrath of God is coming on those who are disobedient, just like he said in Exodus 20. The wrath of God is coming on those who place their life, make their life gratifying towards those things. He even calls greed idolatry. Not money. Not having lots of money. Greed is idolatry. Again and again, we'll see this as we dig deeper into the commandments. The commandments are always about the heart. We think of them as things we do. Jesus says it's really about heart. Having money, not wrong. Loving money more than God and being greedy, idolatry. Having a career, not wrong. Making career a priority over everything else, including God, faith, family, and anything else, an idol. And in Colossians 3, Paul says, set your mind on things above, not on earthly things, not on possessions, not on matters of the heart that capture your heart. Pull you away and make you unfaithful to God. Those are idols. And you're breaking the commandment. So this idea that Paul would say set, like set your heart, set your mind on things above. That's not go lay in your easy chair all day and just think about Jesus. Although that would be a good thing. We couldn't function that way. You would not have a job the next day. That's how you spend your work day. I was setting my mind on things above. I'm good. But it does beg us to practice loving God with our heart, mind, and soul. So the habits that shape our heart for worshiping God is what Paul's talking about. How do we set our minds on anything? Hey, I really want to make more money this year. How do you do that? Here's my goal sheet. I'm going to do more contacting. I'm going to sell more things. I'm going to do this. This is how I'm going to reach that goal. Paul says, set your mind on things of God. I'm going to love God more this year. Here's how I'm going to do that. I'm going to set and orient my life around loving God and loving other people with his promise. Because as Jesus said, on that hangs all of the commandments. If I love God, I keep the first four. If I love others, I keep the other six. That's a flashback to last one, too. If I love God, I will worship him, I will cut out idols, I will not take his name in vain. I will honor the Sabbath and keep it holy. If I love others, I won't steal, I won't kill, I won't commit adultery, I won't lie, and I won't want what they have that I don't have. Or that I shouldn't. I love others. And then Jews wrote 700 laws and stuff like those. But you only need two. Love God, love others. The practice of that shapes our heart. We have to do this stuff differently in order to think differently. We always get that backwards. If I just change the way I think, if I go to one more Bible study and open the verse of Colossians 3 again, I'll be more Jesus-like and everything will flow from that. The reality is, if I practice loving others, that's where my heart will be shaped in that direction. If I practice worship, if I practice time with God in prayer and ask Him for things, I'm saying I'm not in charge, you are. That shapes my heart. We get it backwards. We need to do that, then it does this. But the actions themselves direct and shape us. That's why we call them spiritual disciplines for a reason. They discipline our heart in the right direction. But we have to actually practice them in order for them to shape our heart in the right direction. I've said this multiple times before, and I always get into it because of diet. If diet was as simple as knowing how to eat right, if a diet was as simple as knowing what to eat, anybody know about how to eat healthy? This one in your life? Anybody know that too many carbs, too much fat is a bad plan?
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We know that. But what tastes good? Carbs and fat.
Too much chocolate.
Too much chocolate, that's what you're telling me again. Right? We know that if we eat that stuff, it's unhealthy. We know that. Why is it so hard not to? We know what's bad for us, but we do it anyway. So knowledge, just for knowledge's sake, knowing right from wrong is not enough. But if you ever go on a diet and you stay on that diet, what happens? I'm not eating that. That will screw everything up. That doesn't taste as good as it used to. Why? Because we've disciplined our heart and our desire in another direction. Yes, it's a food illustration at almost lunchtime, which is dangerous, but you get the idea. Now, every year at lunch, you go, can't have the carbs, Charlie said so. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, once we go down this path, the momentum of going down the path keeps us on that path. So when he says, set your heart on things above, then the practices that push our heart towards God are the things that set our heart on things above. That's why we practice. It's one of the reasons. This is a spiritual practice. It's an established covenant between who? Jesus and his bride. And we say things like, do this in remembrance of me. Whenever you eat this food, whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you do so in remembrance of me until we do it again, man, in my Father's kingdom together. It's a practice that brings us back to the heart of the relationship. That reminds me of an 80s great song or somewhere. It brings us back to the center of our relationship, which is Christ and what Christ did for us. It's a symbol. It's a sacred symbol, of course. Right? It represents what Christ did for us so that we can have a relationship with Him. But it also becomes His grace for us. Because that's part of the spiritual sacred mystery. This is the marriage feast of the covenant family that's in this together. God has bound himself to us, and we are binding ourselves to him so that we can be in relationship forever. And if we don't keep the relationship, God will be upset, just like our spouse will be with us. But you're married. When you're married, we have a fight. I guess we're not married here. Is that how it works?
Hey, don't talk to her about that.
My co-pastor's helping today. Is that how it works? Now, eventually, yes. Are there divorces because there's enough fights that it just piles up? Of course. That happens. Because people can't keep the covenant together. They can't be in relationship together. It's a whole other sermon. Get to eventually. Alright. But this morning we are going to practice the sacred practice of union. So